Girls Fight Crime.
Ooh. Yeah.
Bobble by the month.
It's incredible.
Bobble by the month.
So mighty.
Bobble by the month.
Fantastic.
Bobble by the month.
Uncanny.
Bobble by the month.
Just when I was warming up.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to Marvel by the Month. My name's Brian Stratton.
And mine is Rob Milne.
And we are very excited to be chatting with you. This episode, if we are keeping to our schedule, is going to be dropping the week after Thanksgiving. But we are recording it the week before Thanksgiving. So Rob, as professional podcasters, we have to preserve this illusion that we have carefully crafted. Mm-hmm. Because podcast listeners don't understand that when you're talking to them, it was actually recorded at some point in the past. So just in order to stay consistent with this little world that we've built, how do you predict your Thanksgiving will have been?
Well, I will talk about it as though it has already happened.
Exactly.
Of course.
Yes.
Thanksgiving was great. We stayed at home. We have a post-op kitty.
Nice.
So we are taking care of the cat. Barb makes a delicious tofurkey roast. I mean, made. we're going to have to retcon something. With beets and potatoes, and I beg for pumpkin pie, and mm-hmm. I get it.
Nice.
Then Friday we're going to have my dad and stepmom over and play some games, probably Cards Against Humanity.
The perfect game to play with dad and stepmom.
They love it. They're the least appropriate parents anyone could ever have, which helped me, you know, be the person I am now.
Yeah, no, that's
how about
great.
You? How was your Thanksgiving?
My Thanksgiving was great also. I have my wife's mom is in from out of town. My wife's mom up until recently was in from out of town. My folks came over and my brother came down from Seattle. We had a couple friends and neighbors over also for a big old Thanksgiving style feast.
Wow. The Stratton house is hosting.
We got, we have an extra long table, and we put another extra long table adjacent to that. So it's great. It's like, it's very Dickensian. It's just, you know, gather around and celebrate companionship and family and all those great things. So yeah, lots to be thankful for.
Nice. You just, as long as we don't remember what the holiday actually is, we're gonna be good.
Exactly. Right. Yes.
So,
yes.
Sorry, Indigenous peoples.
Yeah. Thank you to whoever we got our turkey from. We still haven't figured out where the logistics of the turkey.
You're really messing up this time travel thing.
Oh, man. It's like trying to live in two times simultaneously. This is how Dr. Manhattan feels all the time.
This is how Kang feels all the time.
Neither of whom have been introduced yet, but will at some point in the future. Mm-hmm. Because I'm going to bring it all back around. Because all seven of this month's comics that we're going to be talking about on this podcast right now, which was certainly being talked about.
You got yourself in a time trap.
I did. All seven of this month's comics are cover dated June 1964. And that means that they started appearing on newsstands in April of 1964. So I think we should go ahead and, as we always do, start out by talking about what was happening in the world when these comics hit the stands. But first, this is something I keep meaning to do and I keep forgetting to do, but I'm going to do it this time. We use Wikipedia for a lot of our research, especially for the contextual stuff that we do at the start of each episode. And we're really bad at giving them credit. We really, you know, should have been doing this all yes. along. We are actually pretty good at giving them financial support. Wikipedia works under a crowdfunded model. So only like 1% of people who use Wikipedia actually contribute to it. So if you are coming up on maybe a little bit of end of year giving planning, Wikipedia is a nonprofit, and I would like to suggest that perhaps you throw a little bit of cash their way.
Oh yeah.
Because it is like, it's a really cool, you know, democratized source of information that is freely available to everybody. And you can go ahead and, donate at donate.wikimedia.org. So yeah, throw them a few bucks.
Do it. And you don't have to look through microfiche because of them.
Yeah, seriously. Or, you know, well, I think probably a lot of our listeners are too young to remember like actual physical encyclopedias, but like I remember in the early days of internet, you know, first there were like CD-ROM versions of encyclopedias, and then there was like you could buy a subscription to Encyclopedia Britannica, which is basically like a gated community Wikipedia, where, you know, no one could contribute to it and you couldn't even access the information unless you paid them like a ridiculous sum of money.
Yes. In monthly installments in most of the people I know.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and Wikipedia is really cool. Like it's, you know, it, like I said, it's freely available to everybody. And you know, inaccurate stuff slips through sometimes, but like with the whole idea that anybody can be editing it and anybody can be, you know, commenting or flagging edits as problematic, it actually does a pretty good job of it. It's very hard to kind of hack. Like it's hard to intentionally inject misinformation into Wikipedia that winds up going unchallenged.
Yeah, so, it's crowdsourced policing of information.
Yeah.
It's, and it works in it, this case. It's, you know, it's not YouTube comments. That's
exactly.
For sure.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you know, it is also kind of going to be weird when, you know, alien civilization 50,000 years from now digs up our digital records and they see that, you know, we have 100 times more information about Battlestar Galactica than we did the Revolutionary War, but you know,
it will be confusing. Also, this podcast might confuse some aliens too.
Yeah, hopefully.
Hopefully it's the infant terrible.
Oh, yeah.
Which is easy to confuse.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, that was kind of the whole point of that story. Okay, so we've done our good deed for the day. Let's talk about what was going on in April 1964. So on April 3rd, 1964, Malcolm X gave his famous The Ballot or the Bullet speech at the Cory Methodist Church in Cleveland, Ohio, calling on African Americans to reconsider the policy of nonviolent resistance in pursuit of equal rights. "Don't be throwing out any ballots," he told the crowd. "A ballot is like a bullet. You don't throw out your ballots until you see a target, and if that target is not within your reach, keep your ballot in your pocket." He closed by saying, "In areas where the government has proven itself either unwilling or unable to defend the lives and property of Negroes, it's time for Negroes to defend themselves. This doesn't mean you're going to get a rifle and form battalions and go looking for white folks, although you'd be within your rights. If the white man doesn't want the black man buying rifles and shotguns, then let the government do its job. That's all. In 1964, it's the ballot or the bullet." So, yeah, I mean, we have mentioned a couple times that, you know, as Stan Lee is setting up the whole like Professor X and Magneto, you know, flip sides of the civil rights issue. That's pretty Magneto-y language right there.
Yeah, he is. And it always sounds, I'm sure it sounded terrifying now. I mean, then sounds a little terrifying now, but it sounds to me, it always sounds like, yeah, I mean, that's fair.
Mm-hmm.
Like that voice is fair. It's like, it's a voice, a real voice of real anger.
Yeah.
You know, well, in different news, on April 2nd, the Beatles wrapped up recording on A Hard Day's Night, the album, was their first album of all original music. Also during April, the Beatles went on a little break after they filmed that, did some shows, and they held during that break the top five positions in the Billboard Top 40 singles in America.
That
so
is
all
wild.
Five from different albums, too. They were Can't Buy Me Love, Twist and Shout, She Loves You, and I Want to Hold Your Hand, and Please Please Me. Also during April into May and June, 60% of singles being sold in the US were by the Beatles.
Wow.
So all music being sold, 60% of singles were the Beatles.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So April was a good month for them. They realized, you know, it was a thing.
Oh, absolutely. No, I mean, Beatlemania was absolutely a real thing. Like
But the U.S., they just were breaking in the U.S. and this was it. This is where they were like, oh, yeah, this is we are a thing. We get to take a break. This is going to keep happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's nuts because like it was just in January that they appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Yeah.
And so you're talking like 3 months later, they've basically taken over the music industry.
Yeah. So it's hard to even imagine somebody moving that quickly. And even, you know, huge celebrities with millions or billions of dollars behind their promotion, like nobody moves like that.
Yeah. Wild. I've got a couple updates here. April 16th, the Rolling Stones, you may have heard of them, released their first album called The Rolling Stones.
Good name.
It was recorded by Decca and placed on sale in the United Kingdom, so it had not come to the United States yet. And then the next day, April 17th, Shea Stadium opened in Flushing, New York. 48,736 people watched the New York Mets host the Pittsburgh Pirates. The Mets predictably lost the game 4-3 on a ninth inning single by the Pirates' Willie Stargell. So, yeah, Mets gonna Met. but, yeah, if you remember, Shea Stadium had been referred to a couple times, I think, in Iron Man stories, where Tony Stark's corporate headquarters was based, like, right near the new baseball stadium.
Right, by the World's Fair, too.
Exactly. Yeah. On April 22nd, the 1964 New York World's Fair opened, and it opened to celebrate the 300th anniversary of New Amsterdam being taken over in 1664 by British forces under the Duke of York and being renamed New York. So there you go, 300 years of New York when the World's Fair opened. The fair would run until October 18th, 1964. Then it would come back again in 1965 from April 21st to October 17th.
On April 29th, 1964, after 7 days of technical problems, the first animatronics replication of a human being was unveiled to visitors to the New York World's Fair. The Disneyland story presenting great moments with Mr. Lincoln at the fair's Illinois Pavilion. The figure of former U.S. President Abraham Lincoln was programmed with nearly 275,000 possible combinations of gestures and movements, which, when you consider processors or not processors right at that time, insane. These were synchronized with pre-recorded speech and was the first product of Disney's audio animatronics engineering. After 7 performances, however, the lifelike electronic Lincoln stopped working for the day. But still.
Yeah, it's not exactly a Doombot.
It's an achievement towards Doombots.
Right, exactly. So yeah, that's a little glimpse into what the readers of the era were seeing in the news when these issues hit the stands. We are going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to put Rob in the Marvel by the Minute chamber, which he can't wait, and neither can I. So stay tuned. Okay, welcome back to Marvel by the Month. Rob, it's time for Marvel by the Minute.
Okay.
So listeners to the program may remember that there are way too many comics coming out every month for us to talk about each and every one individually. And it's only going to get worse from here. So what we do is we talk about 3 of them in detail, and everything else winds up going into this segment where Rob gets 1 minute to hit all the high points of everything that happened that month in that issue. So I will go ahead and set the first one up. This one's going to be Journey into Mystery number 105, which has 2 stories, The Cobra and Mr. Hyde, which was written by Stan Lee, art by Jack Kirby, inked by George Bell, and it's Thor versus the team of Cobra and Mr. Hyde. And then we have a Tales of Asgard short backup story, When Heimdall Failed, which is written by Stan Lee with art by Jack Kirby. Rob, are you ready?
I guess.
Okay. We've got 60 seconds on the clock and go.
Okay, so first of all, we get to see Thor with the Avengers as they're doing their sort of weekly meeting, going, I guess nothing's happening. I'm heading out. And that's the start. then he goes back to be lame Dr. Blake, pines over Jane Foster some more. Cobra and Mr. Hyde get into a bit of a fight, and they then realize they both hate Thor, so they team up to go beat up Thor. In this case, they don't somehow take Jane Foster hostage, which is really unusual. Well, they briefly do, I guess, just briefly. then Thor ends up winning through some weird God of Thunder hearing and some other things. Then we jump into Heimdall. I'm just going to say he wins. Then there's the second story of Heimdall. This thing called a Vanna, that's like a fairy, is ordered to sneak past him into Asgard to get information, and
That was pretty solid right out of the chamber. I'll just mention the Thor Mr. Hyde Cobra story is a first part of a cliffhanger.
He didn't win.
He didn't win. Yeah. So Blake decides, like, well, I want to settle down with Jane Foster, so I can't be Thor anymore. So I'm going to lock my cane away in this.
Those were important.
Right.
And those are important high points.
Yeah. In this man-sized safe, like Dick Cheney used to have. And then, of course, the second he does that, they show up and take him hostage. So there's your cliffhanger there. And then, like, I have a problem with them calling the backup story When Heimdall Failed. Mm-hmm. Because, like, so, like you were saying, what was that thing called?
Vanna.
Yeah. Like, it's too small and too fast. So it, like, flits right by him. But he knows that something happened.
And he reports it.
And he reports it. And he warns everyone. And then they catch the thing.
Yeah.
He didn't fail.
That was pretty sensational.
Yeah.
It was like somebody writes sensationally there.
Yeah. Fake news.
Oh, man. I do not remember anything about this next one.
Well,
if this is right.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Tales to Astonish, number 56. This story is called The Coming of the Magician, which is written by Stan Lee, art by Dick Ayers. It's Giant Man and Wasp versus the Magician in his first appearance. And I think he only has one more appearance after this. And it's like 40 years later.
Man.
And he's basically just a joke in the back of an Ant-Man comic. And again, it's, you know, it's another issue where they could have used the Miracle Man from Fantastic Four, number three.
Yeah,
but
should have.
Nope. His phone is not ringing. You've got 60 seconds on the clock to tell us about all the stuff that you have no idea what actually happened.
I read this like on Sunday, but I can't remember.
Well, go.
Okay. So we have the usual, actually starts out kind of interesting. We have, Henry Pym, he has a ring he's got engraved to give. He's going to propose to the Wasp. So he's going to, you know, actually, I don't know, fulfill all those weird things that we talked about for many issues. Then he sees the Magician, or the ants are trying to get his attention, and they finally tell him about the Magician. The Magician is doing a show where he steals a bunch of stuff from rich people. So Henry Pym decides to rent an entire boat and an alternate boat to throw a party on it to lure the Magician. So he does. It's really costly, I would guess. But he manages to lure the Magician to this boat. And then his shrinking and growing makes the Magician think he's disappearing too. He figures out the Magician is, of course, doing sleight of hand and other tricks. And with the help of the Wasp, is able to catch him. She basically rescues him.
That was super solid for not having any idea when we first started thinking about this issue. Like, I'm amazed at your recall, and your ability to cram what is a pretty insane story into 1 minute.
Oh, yes, it is. It does make me sweat. Every one of these minutes produces sweat.
Well, it's good. It's good to get your heart rate up, you know, it's a fitness thing. And it's a little weird that now all of a sudden he's totally on board with like proposing to her where like
she was a child.
Yeah, I was gonna like, say, like
2 months ago still.
Yeah,
I mean,
man. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, he hasn't called her a child for maybe 4 months.
That's true.
So
yeah.
Maybe she's not a child anymore. It's been 4 months. I don't know legally what it is.
Yeah.
They don't specify.
Right. Yeah. I mean, time is weird in comics. Like some characters, you know, over 30 years, they don't age a day. And then apparently Jan goes from being like, no, I can't even think about her that way, to being is like, I'm going to marry this lady.
Yep.
Well, okay.
Again, see. Here's another one I can barely remember. We'll see what happens as I glance at it and babble.
All right, cool. Well, it's the Return of the Mandarin. This is Tales of Suspense, number 54. Story is called The Mandarin's Revenge. It's written by Stan Lee with art by Don Heck. And then there is a backup story by our good friend Larry Lieber, who wrote it and illustrated it. Got a plotting assist by his brother Stan, and inking by Chick Stone. The story is called Hands Off, and it puts Uatu the Watcher's non-interference vow to the test.
I vaguely remember that too.
All right. Oh, and before we get going, we'll just mention on the cover, it shows the Mandarin hitting Iron Man with some sort of green ray from one of his rings, and it's totally obscuring Iron Man's face. And then we are teased, wait till you see Iron Man's new protective head mask. So, all right, there you go.
That's, you've pretty much given away most of it. Okay.
The hype machine is in full effect. Head mask. And 60 seconds on the clock. Go for it.
So immediately we see the head mask. It's he doesn't have the pointy things on the yellow face part. Now he just has some rivets right down the middle and around the edges, mm-hmm. between the red and the
gold. Still got that widow's peak.
Yep.
Yep.
So he's just farting around in his armor. And then he goes, he gets back to his office and finds out the Pentagon wants to talk to him. It's the sort of usual Tony Stark thing where something's going wrong with his weapons and they're doubting him or thinking he might be a commie or whatever. You know, they just always doubt him. So he tries to figure it out, finds out his missiles are being drawn in by some weird force, happens to be where he, right around where he met the Mandarin before. So he goes and fights with the Mandarin again. The Mandarin doesn't use judo, weirdly. He uses karate this time. They have quite a fight, and I don't even have time to go into it right now because I'm going to jump over to the Watcher, who basically thinks he should interrupt this radioactive cloud that's going to endanger our planet, but then doesn't.
Yeah, but then he doesn't, and it turns out that the radioactive cloud saves the planet from a greater catastrophe.
Yep.
So
he learns the lesson of, you know,
of his dad,
of being hands off.
Yeah. And he talks about his dad was the one who came up with the non-interference vow. Yeah, so Uatu's got a dad,
and he's the son of the main, you know, whatever Watcher clan.
Yeah.
He also, you know, again, the prime directive, hands off.
Exactly. Yeah. There's also, there's a panel in here in the Watcher story. It's like the second or third to last panel where Watch is just like looking straight at the reader, and he says, "Thus, by keeping my vow and doing nothing, I have saved an entire population." He just has the smuggest expression on his face.
Sounds like it makes, such manifest destiny nonsense.
Just
too.
Yeah. Makes me so angry looking at him. I don't know what it is exactly. It's just like, you know, I don't know.
I like that so much.
It's very upsetting. Okay. And the Iron Man story is a cliffhanger also. So Mandarin's got him held prisoner, and we'll see if Iron Man gets out of it next
probably
week.
Not.
He probably won't. Okay, we got one left to go.
Oh, man.
It's return of one of our very favorite villains, who has the most logical backstory and powers. This is Strange Tales number 121, Prisoner of the Plant Man, written by Stan Lee with art by Dick Ayers. It's the Human Torch versus the Return of the Plant Man, who's no less insane. He's got a new costume.
It's worth mentioning that we, with the Doctor Strange story that's in here too, mm-hmm. Doctor Strange's name is getting bigger on each of these covers.
Yes.
And the space given to, you know, now that this is like a 2/3 top Human Torch, 1/3 bottom Doctor Strange on the cover.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, that's actually a good note. All the anthology titles, the actual name of the book is getting smaller and smaller.
And the name
and
of
the characters
heroes? Yeah.
are getting bigger and bigger. So, like, it actually took me a second to find some.
I feel
of
like I should make a like an animated GIF of that process. It'd be pretty fun.
Yeah. But yeah, you're right. I mean, the book's called Strange Tales. Doctor Strange is a character in it. He's getting more and more prominence. And honestly, you know, it's probably a better story than the Human Torch one, but I'll let you recap both of them and then we'll let the readers decide. The Doctor Strange story is Witchcraft in the Wax Museum, written by Stan Lee, art by Steve Ditko. It's another Doctor Strange versus Baron Mordo extravaganza. We have 60 seconds on the clock and go.
Okay. So, Johnny Storm versus the Plant Man 2. Plant Man has a cooler costume. Johnny, mainly the main plot point is he plans ahead this time,
yes.
which is very unusual. He talks to the Fantastic Four, tells them he's got it. He goes after the Plant Man. The Plant Man decides he's going to, has a plan for plants to take his girlfriend Doris hostage, but he's already planned to have, the thing be there to stop the plants from hurting Doris. So he can just take the Plant Man into custody. Done. Nice. Doctor Strange. This is awesome. So Mordo returns. Mordo ends up stealing Doctor Strange's physical body when he's in his astral form, and he can't find it for a long time. And if he's out of his body for 24 hours, he can't get back into it. He dies. So he is desperately searching for his body, finds it in a wax museum, and then has this cool fight with Mordo. Awesome Ditko work in this.
Yes. There's some really cool panels in here. I think a lot of these are going to wind up going on our Instagram account. Or at least a couple of them, because some of the,
it's way better. Is no longer just these two guys staring at each other. It's the way each sort of magical spell that happens in the fight are all done differently, and they're all done so awesomely, so trippy. Really cool.
It feels very unreal. It's really good use of negative space. I really love it. And then the illustration of the binding spell that Strange uses on Mordo at the end of the story is great. It looks like it's sort of like the same pattern of the window in Doctor Strange's
his sort of sigil.
So good stuff. And it's Ditko, you can't go wrong.
And I happily didn't waste a lot of time with the Human Torch and got straight over to Doctor Strange, which was, I think, the better story.
Cool. All right. Well, that's Marvel by the Minute. Rob, once again, you rose to the occasion.
I surprised myself.
Well, that's good. So we're going to go ahead and take our second break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the second issue of Daredevil on Marvel by the Month. Welcome back to Marvel by the Month. It's time to talk about Daredevil number 2. The story is called The Evil Menace of Electro. It was written by Stan Lee with art by Joe Orlando and Vince Coletta. And I think Joe Orlando and Vince Coletta, I think these are two new names.
For the bullpen,
For the bullpen.
I was really surprised to see the names change from issue 1 of Daredevil to issue 2. I mean, other than Stan.
Yep.
Like the creative, totally different, different look. It was really surprising.
Yeah, and very different tone too.
Yeah, this whole issue, totally different tone.
Yeah. So I think we've mentioned this before also, that apparently Daredevil number 1 had been in the can for months. Mm-hmm. It just didn't get done when they wanted to release it. So Stan wound up doing the Avengers instead. So Daredevil number 1 was sitting out there. Bill Everett had done it. When it was time for it to be an ongoing series, I don't know, maybe Everett was not available, Orlando and Coletta were, so they got the gig. Just thought I would take a couple minutes, and introduce them, because, these guys may be new to Marvel, but they are certainly not new to the comics industry. Mm-hmm. Joe Orlando, he was a pretty famous artist by that point already. Got his start in comics as an assistant to Wally Wood, in the 50s, actually in the late 40s also. He became a regular staff artist for EC Comics in 1951, was featured regularly in their Monster and Sci-Fi mags. After EC Comics was put out of business by the Comics Code, he wound up drawing all sorts of stuff, classics, illustrated adaptations. He wrote the Little Orphan Annie comic strip. He was a very prolific illustrator. He wound up being an illustrator and story editor for Creepy Magazine, which is published by Warren Publishing.
Oh yeah. I remember that.
Yeah. This is something that I think everyone listening to the podcast will know exactly what I'm talking about, but he was the artist responsible for the Sea Monkeys ads in, comics of the era. And for years later, they would just use the same things. So if you remember like the little fish creatures, that looked nothing like actual sea monkeys.
Nope. That was such a disappointment.
Yeah. Man. Well, that's Joe Orlando.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for nothing.
Joe sold some brine shrimp in bags by making those cartoon drawings. I'm like, there's going to be a kingdom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I think like years and years and years later, I think like in the 90s or the 2000s, I think there was actually a sea monkeys cartoon, like a very short lived one. Mm-hmm. Howie Mandel was like the star voice in, and they use the same design, like
that was the characters were based on those drawings.
Yeah. And he, you know, outside of illustration, he went on to become a vice president of DC Comics. He was an associate publisher of Mad Magazine after William Gaines died. And this, I think, is a really cool credit. At Alan Moore's insistence, he illustrated a supplemental text piece in Watchmen. And it's the only illustration in the entire comic that was not done by Dave Gibbons.
That's pretty awesome. That's like Alan Moore's stamp of approval, which is worth a lot.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Joe Orlando, just awesome, awesome guy, amazing artist. I'm a huge EC Comics fan. I've got a ton of the EC, archives that, Dark Horse has been printing. And the Joe Orlando stories are always some of my favorites. And then he was inked in this issue by Vince Coletta. And he got his start penciling and inking romance comics for like literally just about everyone in the early 1950s. Like this was, that was his niche. He just did romance. In the 1960s, he started inking for Marvel Comics, and he would primarily be an inker for the rest of his career. Mm-hmm. Starting next month on this very podcast, he's going to start inking Jack Kirby's Thor. I think he starts out by doing the Tales of Asgard stories and then winds up going to the main stories. He stayed on the book for 6 years.
Cool. By next month, you mean next week?
Next week.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. He, when Kirby went to DC Comics in the 1970s, he followed Kirby over there and inked a bunch of his stuff there. He was named an art director at DC, or the art director at DC, in 1976. Coletta had a reputation. He was known as an extremely fast inker. He was not always held in the highest regard by every artist. And, you know, I think these two things go hand in hand, right? Like if you have a reputation as being a fast guy, you get the books that need to be done yesterday.
Yep.
And does that give you a ton of time to be working on all the little background details and fine, you know, line work?
Yep.
Not really.
You just, you're going to stay that way because what you can produce is that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and some artists were, you know, fine with it. They understood the business. Some of them were a little more vocal about it. Mark Evanier has a story that I'm just going to read verbatim. And Evanier says, in 1970, when Steve Sherman and I met Steve Ditko, he asked us about the new Kirby books that were then about to debut at DC. When we told him Coletta was handling the inking, he winced and said that he would probably not look at the comics.
Wow.
Back when he was working for Marvel, this is wild, Ditko said he'd pick up the latest issues in the office and always check the credits before taking the comics home. If he found Coletta's name, especially as Kirby's embellisher, he would make a point of putting the comic book back or even in a wastebasket, and he'd make sure Stan saw what he was doing and knew the reason why.
That's we're starting to get the Ditko stories going here.
Yeah. But
that's harsh.
Yeah. But I'm not going to end on that note. Cause you know, Coletta did a ton of work. And some of it I actually really like, especially his Thor stuff. And then there's this little anecdote. So while he was serving as art director for DC, he took a chance on a raw talent who had recently been beaten up pretty badly by Joe Orlando, who was pretty vicious about his estimation of the young artist's skills. This was a young man who'd recently moved to New York City from central Vermont. That young man's name was Frank Miller.
Yeah.
So, you know, he couldn't have been all bad.
No, he made that call.
Yeah.
Man, that seems so crazy. It's not bad. It's not like, I guess Ditko wasn't going to see Larry Lieber's art in a book and throw it away.
Right.
Like a book that he's in, you know?
Yeah.
But still, I would put what I've seen of these comics, the inking is fine.
Oh, absolutely. Like, yeah.
Jeez.
Well, and also like, let's consider the source also. Like I can count probably on one hand and have fingers left over the number of Steve Ditko stories who have been inked by anyone except Steve Ditko.
Right.
So far. So, you know, someone may have some control issues.
Yeah. Wow.
Anyway, we were talking about Daredevil.
Yeah. So let me take you through this one.
Cool.
So the story starts with the Thing busting literally into the Nelson and Murdoch law office. So we get the Thing, Benjamin Grimm from the Fantastic Four, in Daredevil number 2, crashing through the door into his office.
Yeah.
So he wants a lawyer to look over the Fantastic Four's lease on their headquarters, the Baxter Building. Foggy doesn't do that sort of work, but Matt does. But he's not there.
Oh, where could he be?
Matt, as Daredevil, is busting up a stolen car ring run by Spider-Man foe Electro. So this cross-pollinating thing just keeps on going.
Yep.
Electro decides that he's going to pivot to breaking into the Fantastic Four's headquarters while they're out of town and steal Reed's scientific secrets. So,
which is a real bold move because it's like, dude, you couldn't run a stolen car ring properly.
I know.
It's not, now you're going to go steal secrets from the world's smartest man.
Yeah. So Daredevil busts up the ring and he's like, I was bored with it anyway. I'm going to go break into the most, you know, secure location ever. Not the brightest dude.
No.
So
I mean, wattage wise, yes,
he's very bright in that way. Ta-ta, psh. So Matt enters the Baxter Building and changes into Daredevil for some reason. And he gets into another scrap with Electro. I love that. Cause he's Matt Murdock.
Yeah.
And then there's just a lengthy explanation about this transformation in the next panel. Daredevil.
It's really clear that like Orlando just did not, he did not think through the transition or. Like he just kind of, you know, it's like,
he's like, Daredevil's there now.
Yeah. Yeah.
We showed his alter ego going into the building. You get it. Right.
And so Stan has to like put in like a 6 or 7 line text box at the
Matt
top.
Murdock takes off his normal clothes and puts on his Daredevil outfit. And now he is Daredevil inside of the Baxter Building.
But Electro definitely didn't see him do that. So it also says it's still okay.
It's pretty ridiculous. So then it gets even crazier.
Yeah.
Electro beats Daredevil and sends him on a one-way trip into space aboard the FF's rocket. So he beats him up, shoves him in a rocket, and in the first of what will be many improbable applications of his powers, Daredevil lands the rocket safely in Central Park, and then he steals a horse. So
I love the stealing the horse part.
This landing the rocket thing is insane because it's going to great lengths to talk about how he somehow, with no sight, is running these controls and figuring them out and being able to tell where he is in space.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's totally insane.
Yes.
Like even if you project to like the most sonar version of his powers, he's in a rocket.
Yeah.
You know, it's like
that he's never seen before and has no familiarity. It's not like he was a rocket pilot before he lost his vision. Yeah. You know, it's like
he's just going to walk over and start smashing some controls and hope for the best. It's like me playing Street Fighter or something.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So maybe his power is actually supernatural luck. And not anything else.
He's got the domino power.
Yeah.
Or Scarlet Witch. So he steals his horse. That was also cool. He just sort of, you know, grabs a horse that happens to be there.
Yep.
Then he returns to the Baxter Building aboard a sightseeing helicopter.
Yeah, it's like he hitches a ride on the bottom of this like sightseeing tour copter.
Yeah. Yeah, he like runs up to a roof, jumps on it. It's just crazy to go from Daredevil number one to what's happening in this episode. So Electro flees with Daredevil in pursuit. They fight in a movie theater and Daredevil drops a curtain on him.
Yeah.
Somehow resist the temptation to say that it's curtains for Electro. Police show up and blast Electro with fire hoses to keep him short circuited. Of course.
Yeah.
And the issue wraps up with the FF returning to Nelson and Murdock. They can't believe that the review of their lease isn't done yet. And the FF take their business elsewhere and Foggy is distraught. I did not see that one coming.
No.
I thought there would be this connection that would form there. But they're just like, you didn't do the job, man.
Yeah,
we're out.
We asked you to do one thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think also something that we didn't mention was like the lengths that Matt goes to. Like he repairs the safe that Electro busted into in the Baxter Building.
Right.
Like, but
did he get the rocket back in there?
Say, that's the thing. Like, I mean, good job fixing the safe, but aren't they going to wonder why their rocket is in Central Park?
Five-story rocket missing from the corner, you know?
Yeah, it's wild. So, and I think you've alluded to this a couple of times, but like there's a huge contrast between Daredevil number two and Daredevil number one. Like the first issue, it's this very street level crime story.
Yeah, it's awesome. It starts off that way. Even with Electro, when he's breaking up the car ring, he's doing very Daredevil things,
right.
Like, you know, using some engine hoist to push an engine at somebody and,
yes,
you know, doing, he's on the piers, he's with thugs, you know, he's working, yeah, it out.
Yep.
And then even, so you're like, okay, well, maybe this is going to work, but Electra seems like a little bit, I mean, he's of a different super grade.
Villainy. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And then it just gets totally bonkers.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it's like, and now Daredevil's in space.
Yeah.
What?
And this is so crazy.
Yeah. And I mean, this though is like, this is a tension that's going to play out. Like, in honest to God, until Frank Miller winds up writing him in the '80s, like, mm-hmm, it's, there's Daredevil veers wildly back and forth between being like a very grounded, you know, very realistic kind of hero.
Yeah.
And then also like going on cosmic adventures periodically. Yep. And
so weird.
Yeah.
The character, obviously, I mean, knowing, just seeing the origin, yeah, and then knowing everything about him and knowing the Netflix show and everything. It's, yeah, like, yeah, the character is so, he's also so defined by Hell's Kitchen. And yes, I know a lot of this Frank Miller did when, mm-hmm, they were taking a risk, like they were going to cancel it anyway.
Right.
So they're like, sure, let's let this, you know, illustrator take a shot at,
yeah,
it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Writing.
Yep.
And yeah.
Yeah. Cause you know, Denny O'Neill had been writing the book and then he's like, I think I'm pretty much done with Daredevil. I've done everything I can do with this character.
Yeah.
And then Frank's like, well, I got a couple ideas and
that was great. And then
the rest is history.
Batman got pretty cool too for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah. So, I mean, in addition to like this weird contrast, but there's so much of this issue that just does not make any sense at all.
Mm.
So we talked about like the unexplained change into the superhero identity that takes place at some point between when Matt walks through the front door of the Baxter building and when Electra sees him on the screen. But you know, it's like, again, like how does he fly the rocket? How does Electro know how to fly, like launch the rocket? Like he's a lineman, you know?
Yeah. it's all crazy. I think Electro actually tries to launch the rocket, but Reed has made it so it's almost impossible it's impossible to do.
Uh-huh.
So he just shoots a bunch of electricity into the control panel,
right,
and it,
right,
launches the rocket.
Yeah.
I'm like, that is a weird stretch of his power too.
Yeah. Yeah.
So many stretches.
Yes.
I have to say though that I think the art's pretty cool. Daredevil 1, and I wasn't here for that, yeah, podcast, but it has a very cartoony feel, like, yeah, like Sunday comics sort of feel.
Totally.
This has that a little bit, but then it just gets, when he's doing like it's a little flat, but in some places, but all the action looks great and it,
yeah,
looks like really realistic and it's like it's like Kirby light. Like there's not all the forced perspective. It's,
yep,
but there's great camera angles. It's, you know, and that's just me, my multimedia degree.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I always think of the shots, even when I'm framing my own illustration, as camera angles for some reason. It's just like a weird burn in my brain.
Right. Right.
But, yeah, you know, some of it's light, but I thought he did a great job. I think so too.
And especially like in the larger panels, there's so much detail.
Yeah.
In like the crowd scenes, like there's the scene of Daredevil, like in page 16, the scene of Daredevil, like hanging, from the sightseeing helicopter. And he's just like going across, Manhattan.
Yeah. It's a full shot of Manhattan.
It's gorgeous.
Awesome.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And like, that's the kind of like Orlando stuff was, I mean, he had a really good sense of doing like crowd work and like detail stuff. The body language on the characters is great. He does a fist fight better than just about anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, again, like really realistic and grounded. I think, honestly, one of the only things that doesn't quite work in the story, which kind of makes sense considering who the artist is when he draws the Thing. Like,
yep,
the Thing looks a little weird. Like, he looks kind of like a cartoon has been plopped into this, mm-hmm, story.
And even, I mean, some of the normal, when they're showing the Matt Murdock, the foggy scenes, those look a little flat too. It's weird that,
yeah,
I would expect from the Model comics that just people doing normal things would be easier.
Right,
you know,
right,
to something more practiced, but,
yep,
but the action seems great.
Well, that's Daredevil number 2. Let's go ahead and take another break, and then when we come back we'll talk about Amazing Spider-Man number 13 on Marvel by the Month. Okay, welcome back. We're going to talk about Amazing Spider-Man number 13, The story is called The Menace of Mysterio. It's written by Stan Lee with art by Steve Ditko. And I bet you can guess who shows up in this story for the first time.
Is it Mysterio?
It is Mysterio. So I'll just go ahead and dive into this and feel free to jump in wherever it makes sense. So we open by seeing Spider-Man robbing an apartment. Everyone's instantly convinced that Spider-Man is a crook. Like, not even a second thought. That makes a little bit of sense considering, you know, Jameson has been running a pretty relentless campaign against him, you know, for months now. But the crazy thing is that Peter Parker is convinced that Spider-Man's a crook too. He really quickly...
He's worried he's like sleepwalking or something. Yeah,
he very quickly rules out that this is an imposter. He says, nobody else can shoot a web as I do or climb sheer walls the way I can with my spider power. When, like, literally these things have happened
already.
You know, like the chameleon.
I think a couple people have already replicated his power enough to convince people.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he self-diagnoses himself with a split personality disorder. After a second robbery takes place, he decides that he's going to go see a psychiatrist. But then he gets cold feet about seeing the psychiatrist after meeting him because he's afraid that he's going to accidentally give away his secret identity during the therapy. So
that went so fast. It was like he gets in the office. Yeah. It sounds like it's going to happen. The psychiatrist is like, oh, I'm going to be able to write a book on this thing. And then he's like, oh, yep, nope, I'm out.
Yeah.
Like barely, I don't think he sits down on the couch.
He doesn't.
Yeah.
And so I have either never read this story before or it has been so long since I read it, I didn't really remember it very well. I was convinced that the psychiatrist was going to turn out to be Mysterio.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Right.
Yeah.
Like I thought that's what, but no, it's just this weird little dead end. And it's even something that's called out on the cover.
Right. And it's nothing. That was a surprise. I think I thought it would tie into the story. It's just the only tie to the story is Peter Parker's character self-doubt, you know?
That's it.
Speaking of that, Peter has to go out and take photos to make money for Aunt May's mortgage because they had a little conversation about, are you worried about the fact that we can't pay the mortgage? And he's saying, no, Aunt May, I'm not. And then of course he's like desperately worried about
it. I'm constantly worried about everything.
But an angry mob chases him when he's out as Spider-Man. So he has to abandon the plan. And then at the Daily Bugle, Mysterio shows up and says, he'll take care of that crook Spider-Man. And he casts himself as the hero. He tells Jonah to print a notice in the Bugle saying that Spider-Man should meet Mysterio atop the Brooklyn Bridge.
Yeah. So Spidey shows up atop the Brooklyn Bridge, and Mysterio defeats him actually pretty handily with an array of powers. So like Mysterio does things like standing straight out from a wall, like with his feet flat on the wall and he's like parallel to the ground. He can dissolve Spidey's web just by gesturing toward it. He has this tremendous agility, seems to be able to fly. He can generate this fog that Spidey can't see through. And he's also got some sort of device that can nullify Spidey's spider sense. So like Mysterio just he's ahead of Spidey from the jump.
Yeah.
And
does it's like the Doc Ock thing. He just gets butt handed to him.
And this is sort of like I think we're starting to realize like this is the formula for anytime Spidey is like facing a new villain, is like that villain's gonna knock the crap out of him, and then his true heroism is his resilience to come back.
He's gonna get up on one knee, he's gonna hold his hand up and shake his finger at the sky. The crowd's gonna yell, and Hulk Hogan, Peter Parker. Mysterio is given a hero's welcome in the city after he soundly defeats him. Peter plants a spider tracer on him in the Daily Bugle office. So we've seen him use this before, the little spider shaped transmitter, which is way ahead of its time. Mm-hmm. This is like an RFID thing to find your keys. But Spidey tracks Mysterio to his lair, which is a TV movie studio building, which is weird.
Okay.
And Mysterio reveals he's a special effects artist who duplicated, he of course just monologues, a special effects artist who duplicated all of Spidey's abilities and framed him for the robberies. But Spidey records the whole confession. So They brawl across several movie sets, which is pretty cool.
Yes.
Before Spidey smashes Mysterio's Spidey Sense jammer. So yeah. Now his Spidey Sense is working.
Yeah. And this is another like kind of part of the Ditko formula. So we have, you know, the first fight, it's brief. Spider-Man loses it. He comes up with his plan to defeat the villain in round two. And then you get like the second fight is always much longer, and like it's just Ditko just goes all out with
yeah.
you know, and like with the story.
This is the action scenes of the movie. Yeah.
Yeah. And like he's obviously just having a blast drawing this. So Spidey gets the upper hand. He takes Mysterio down. He brings Mysterio and the recorded confession to the police. Jameson is there to see it all happening. And he's distraught. He was wrong again.
It's like he's not right. It's weird.
It's like he's completely off about everything. But his move does improve dramatically when Peter shows up with a bunch of pictures to sell of the battle. And they're so good that it enables Jameson to put out an extra edition of the Bugle. So he's not hurting. Peter gets his money. Mortgage is taken care of. Spidey's reputation is restored. It's a rare happy ending in a Spider-Man comic.
Yeah.
Which is pretty great.
Yeah. And it's the cool part, as if anyone has seen a recent film starring this character known as Spider-Man.
Yes.
It is very close. It matches this very closely. It's like it's modernized and it has a lot of other elements, but it's,
yeah.
I was so surprised because I, on my flight back from Detroit, watched the Spider-Man Far From Home movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've read this comic in a collection many times, but and I've always thought, I used to think my brother and I argued about Mysterio being such a lame character, but he always does these crazy things and you're like, well, there's no way he's not magic or using some, you know, transistors of Tony Stark style.
Right.
But he pulls off so many things, and usually he is using technology to pull it off. But it's which it's so close though for Mysterio. The what they show you in that movie is very much based on this whole story arc.
Yeah,
it's his introduction and how he does it.
Yeah,
and
he sells himself as the hero. Yeah,
yeah,
and it's I think the only departure is that. In Far From Home, they were being real cagey about, is Mysterio going to be the bad guy? Is he not going to be the bad
guy?
I think at this point we can give the spoiler. It's like, he's the bad guy.
If you just listen to everything we just said.
Yeah, exactly. But so in even to the point where like I went and saw the movie with a couple of people who were not familiar with Mysterio as a character.
Yeah.
But they like Jake Gyllenhaal and he's a very charismatic dude.
Yeah.
And they, a couple of them like totally fell for it. Like,
yeah, it's really well done.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I was went in going, are they going to make him a hero somehow?
Right.
And I know this story.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it was like,
well, because they've done that with a couple of characters in the movies, like Baron Mordo doesn't turn on Doctor Strange,
right?
Like in the Doctor Strange movie.
True.
And,
yeah.
And he is like, not only is he Doctor Strange's greatest enemy, but he's like his only enemy for like the first year.
Right. You know? In these 8-page stories or whatever. Right. Yeah.
But no, I was wondering if they were going to do, you know, the Mysterio heel turn and, you know, they did. So basically, like you said, it's exactly what they were, you know, pulling off with Mysterio's origin story here. Except Stan totally ruins it in the comic where the cover blurb says, we've done it. We've created the greatest villain of all for old Spidey.
Right. So if Spider-Man Far From Home also had the tagline with the greatest villain of all, exactly. Mysterio.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, I think Far From Home plays it much closer to the vest, you know, about, you know, and they were really smart about some of the false leads that they sent down, you know, the red herrings that they were putting out there to throw you off the scent.
Yeah.
Even if you were a smart comics fan.
Like, yeah. You know. I was convinced. I mean, I wasn't convinced, but I was like, maybe they're going to go this way.
Right,
maybe this is going to be an alternate thing because
Well, like when they were
like continuity
about,
means nothing yeah, between yeah. comics and the movies and everything.
When
else.
They started teasing things like the multiverse and like, okay, well, maybe this is the Mysterio from a dimension where Mysterio yep. is the hero, you know? Like,
yeah.
So sure. Whatever. But yeah. And you know, in the comic, I don't think it's, we're never supposed to really believe that Mysterio is actually a good guy.
Right.
So like Jameson does, because Jameson just wants to believe the worst about Spider-Man constantly. Right.
That's all he does.
Yeah.
He does not sleep or eat. He yeah. just wants to hate Spider-Man.
Yeah. Which kind of brings me to the question, like, why does anyone believe Jameson about Spidey?
Yeah. It seems anymore? Like that they would, after whatever, 12 false headlines that right. are proved wrong, they would be like, maybe we shouldn't buy the Daily Bugle, you know?
It's, yeah,
it's full of crap.
Or is this just like Lee and Ditko being like eerily predictive about, it's like, look, it's like people decide who they're going to believe, and then whatever they say, they're just going to believe right. that
they which, just lie and yeah. lie hard.
Yeah. Yeah, which I mean, you know, no matter what side of, you know, the political spectrum you happen to be on, like, I think that's a charge that you use at the other side.
Yep.
You know, it's like, oh, you just believe that no matter, you know, it's like you wake up, sheeple.
Yep. But then this isn't actually the origin. We saw yeah. Mysterio before.
We did. Yeah.
He was one of the Tinker's alien henchmen in issue number one.
Yeah. He's a dude in a rubber mask.
Yeah. Yep. So he was there already.
Yeah.
He was, probably responsible for the rubber masks with his special effects, you know,
they
skills.
Were so convincing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then we'll find out. We don't find that out until 1981. So it is a retcon thing, but I'm really glad they did go back and say, not only like tying Mysterio back to it, but just saying, it's like that whole thing about the Tinkerer being an alien, like that thread that we never, ever picked up. Well,
right.
it's like, here's what was actually going on there. Like, you know, so.
And we will talk about Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man, issue number 51. And let's estimate.
Well,
10 years.
Yeah, we get through about 4 years a year. I can't do math, man. I was an English major.
I mean, 4 years a year, that's less than 10 years to get to 1981.
Yeah.
So
I'll trust you.
Yeah.
Well, cool. I'd say we take another break because now my head hurts from trying to do
we suck
basic
at time travel and math.
Oh man, like anything that requires math or science. But good news is when we come back, we're going to talk about Fantastic Four number 27, which I thought was a real good issue.
Yeah.
And has a really pretty major character development. So that's what's called a tease. And when we come back, we will get into it. So don't go anywhere. We have one issue left to cover. It's Fantastic Four, number 27, The Search for Submariner. It's written by Stan Lee, penciled by Jack Kirby, inked by George Bell. And this issue opens with Reed using a new invention that he's created. It's a thought-projecting device. And he's showing everyone that he's imagining Sue in a bathing suit. Super classy, Reed.
Way to go. The whole room full of people seeing what you're thinking.
Including her brother. Sue winds up leaving in a bit of a huff, which I think is completely understandable.
Mm-hmm.
And then Ben asks Reed, and is what's kind of a weird transition, is like, when are you going to propose to her? And Reed says he's planning on going ring shopping later that very day. But
meanwhile, Namor, of course, is in his underwater castle, also thinking of Sue, thinking of her so much he's spying on her with his weird scanner. Also classy.
Oh man, these guys.
So he tells his warriors he's going to go to the surface and bring Sue back as his intended bride, and they're like, hey, she's a, you know, whatever, air breather.
Yeah,
so they quit.
Yep.
Then these are like the last Atlanteans that are hanging out with him.
Yeah, yeah. These are the ones who stuck with him the last time he pulled this.
and they're like, dude, just, you know, like, settle down with some, you know, fishy lady.
Yeah.
Don't go to those pink people.
Get one of them Joe Orlando sea monkey ladies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so, you know, he's without his henchmen. And still goes out because he's Namor to yep. the Baxter building to kidnap Sue.
Yeah.
Cause that's how you show a lady you love her, I guess, if you're Namor. he incapacitates the thing and Torch, then gasses Sue. He like takes just quick measure of them. They're like done.
Yeah. He gets the drop on them real quickly, and they just, you know, they're totally unprepared. He knocks the thing out with like some knockout gas. I can't remember how he takes the torch out, but it's equally brief. And then Sue is just like, no, I'm not going with you. And he's like, nope. So yeah, this courtship is the worst. Reed returns with the ring that he bought. And he finds Ben and Johnny. He's like, where's Sue? And they tell him that Namor has kidnapped her. And at this point, Reed flies into a rage. And it's very out of character for what we have seen of him so far.
Yeah.
He makes the, what will wind up being a much more common facial expression, but it's that Kirby, like, anguished rage, like
grimace.
Open mouth grimace thing. Yeah. Which is like, it's so Kirby, you know, such a fundamental thing, but it's like one of the very first times we've ever seen Reed making this expression.
He lost his temper. Yeah. Even when he was hit with the H ray from the hate monger.
Yeah.
He was less angry.
Yes.
He's in a huff.
Yeah. And he just heads straight out to face Namor alone and rescue Sue. He's just like, not even waiting for Ben and Johnny to help him deal with the situation.
And they're like, you know, even though he's like, I've got this, I'm really mad.
Yeah.
They don't know how to find Namor. So Johnny's like, I know this weird guy from Strange Tales. So he writes a message to Dr. Strange in the sky. Yeah. I'm like, how do you actually, they've heard of him. So,
You know, he's a Ute. He probably hangs out in Greenwich Village. So.
That's true.
Yep.
Smoking the reefer.
Yep.
So this is the first Dr. Strange crossover. So anybody who's been reading these comics would still doubt that he inhabits the same world as the rest of these people.
Right. Because he's never been linked to anyone.
And he doesn't, he's such an unusual hero compared to the rest of them.
Yeah.
So I would, you know, if I were reading this, then I would be like, oh, sweet. He's going to be an actual superhero.
Yeah,
like he's going to be in the universe.
Right. Because like he was also appearing in like, you know, in the anthology books, and there are still stories in those anthology books, mostly by Larry Lieber, that have no connection to the rest of the Marvel universe. But now this is the first time it's like, no, Strange is part of this whole world.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, again, this confirms that he's part of the hero universe.
Yeah.
Dr. Strange travels to Namor's kingdom in his ectoplasmic form. I call it his astral projection. I think that's what they settle on later.
That's what they lean toward. Yeah, yeah.
He sees Namor pleading with Sue to think about his offer of marriage for just 24 hours. You know, once she wakes up from being gassed and kidnapped.
Yeah, yeah.
Strange returns to Ben and Johnny to tell them where it is and that Sue is safe. So it's crazy.
Yeah.
As Strange leaves, Reed enters Namor's castle and it is on.
Yeah. And Reed, like, he puts up seriously a very good fight. Like he's going back and forth with Namor. He's using his speed and his flexibility and his intelligence to counter Namor's strength. And Namor's on his home turf. But, you know, Reed's whole position is like, look, you came to my house
and
you took Sue. It's like, I'm coming to your house and I'm taking her back.
And, yeah.
Yeah. And he's just going for it. It's kind of amazing. Meanwhile, Dr. Strange rejoins Johnny and Ben back at the Baxter building. They take underwater breathing pills that Reed has invented.
Mm-hmm.
And then Dr. Strange just teleports them into Namor's castle because he knows where it is and he's a magic man. At this point, Reed is just barely holding his own against Namor and his troops. But now there's reinforcements. So.
Oh yeah. The troops came back in the middle of this fight. They show up. That's the other important thing. It's like
these guys, they have issues with commitment.
Yeah. Reed's holding his own. And then, you know, Namor gets backup.
Yeah.
And that's exactly when Strange teleports the boys in.
Yep. And so Ben takes on the guards. Reed stays on Namor and Johnny goes and rescues Sue.
So Sue is using her force field to protect everyone. Namor says she's doing it out of loyalty, but Sue tells him she's doing it out of love.
Yeah.
And that's pretty big.
Yeah.
And she says, I'm sorry, Namor. Sorry if you misunderstood the sympathy I felt for you. Yes, even the affection I felt. Sorry if you thought it was love, but I realize now Reed is the only man for me. Nothing can ever change that.
Yeah.
So that's pretty, that's a big statement because it's always been the sort of wishy-washy.
Yep.
Yeah. Thing.
And so Namor just kind of stands there and blinks a few times. And that's when Dr. Strange, he takes that moment to teleport the FF to the submarine that Reed arrived in, and they head for home. And as they are heading back to New York in the sub, Ben asks Sue if she only said what she said to stop them from fighting, and which is like a totally jerk move. Like, and before Sue can answer him, Reed interrupts and he says he doesn't even want to hear the answer. But Sue is thinking to herself, oh, Reed, you blind fool. Of course it's you I love. But how can I ever convince you? You'll always suspect I may have just been trying to protect you or Namor. And that's what we end on. So, yeah, so it starts out with, you know, Reed is ready to propose marriage. And it ends up where he's like, I'm not quite sure if this is actually a thing or not. And it and is apparently uninterested in learning. If, right. If it actually is.
he's so upset. He's still pretty hot from that thing. There's, yeah. It's weird that both Henry Pym and Reed are they're ready for marriage in
there's
this month.
A lot of engagement talk going around. But yeah, so this basically this issue wraps up the whole Reed Namor Sue love triangle. Or I mean it kind of pops up again here and there, but
it solidifies that Sue really likes Reed and Reed really likes Sue.
Exactly.
Like he's not just being this sort of absent, vacant, you know, academic.
Exactly.
He actually has passion for her.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a big deal to close off a storyline like that and like actually bring it to a conclusion. I mean, this has been a story point since the fourth issue of Fantastic Four. So, you know, like this is one of the very first storylines in the Marvel universe that has been a recurring storyline. And now they've brought it to a close. And it's huge because like status quo stuff is such a big thing in comics. You know, part of it is just kind of the you know, what we call in the marketing industry, the step and repeat, you know, like you want to have this like closed system of like, all these characters behave like this, especially, you know, back in the day when you were just churning these things out week after week, month after month. And you need to have all your players, you know, like everyone kind of has to go back in the
box. It's got
to
be reset. Yeah. It's like a sitcom.
Yeah.
It's like no matter what happens in this, whatever arc, this 20 minutes.
Yeah.
It needs to reset.
Yep.
And there may be villains are the only, they're like the red shirts or the stormtroopers. They are expendable. Sometimes they stick around, sometimes they don't, but they're just there as a plot device.
Exactly.
You know?
Yep.
So,
yeah. And I think this also might reflect the fact that I think Stan has more confidence in Namor as a character at this point too. Mm-hmm. Like he's like, I don't think we need to have this be part of his story anymore. Like he's, you know, he's now fought the Avengers. Like he's branched out into his own stuff.
Yeah.
And he's holding his own as a character. And there's a lot of layers to the character that, you know, we don't need to have this love triangle thing also going on in the background. And it also seems like they're ready to move on and have, you know, and move forward with Reed and Sue's story. So, you know, this is the natural conclusion of that.
Yeah. And Doctor Strange.
Yeah. Doctor Strange in the Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
Like this, it's a big deal. That's an easy one to overlook. But yeah, he's clearly a part of this whole world. Johnny knows who he is, and now the whole Fantastic Four has interacted with him.
Yeah.
So yeah,
he has aided them more than, you know, certainly Ant-Man.
Yes, exactly.
When Ant-Man shows up to help them, it's just like he showed up a few times, and it was just always, or at least two, were on his own.
Yep.
Where it was just no help, nothing.
And I think that's the only Marvel character now that hasn't been connected to other Marvel characters in some way, like. You know, because Daredevil had his thing with Electro.
Yeah, and the Fantastic Four. Like Ben walks in the first panel.
Right.
He's obviously integrated into the full universe.
Yep. So yeah. So there you go. Cohesive Marvel universe.
Ta-da.
We've just got one last thing to do, and that's our panel of the month. We're gonna take a quick break and tell you what stuck out to us this month. Welcome back. It's time to talk about our panels of the month. And since we were just talking about Fantastic Four, I think I'll go ahead and lead off with mine, which comes from that issue. It's on page 18, panel 1. It's this, it's a large, like half page panel of, Ben juggling Namor's troops while Reed and Namor are tussling in the background. And one of the things I love about it is that, it's just, it's Kirby art. So the composition is fantastic, but like looking at it, like physically, it does not make any sense. Like
there's no way
that
it's
he's
an elliptical juggling pattern.
it's like he's juggling guys who are like 5 feet to the left of him and like somehow coming back around.
Yeah.
So it just looks super goofy, but at the same time, there's so much energy to it. And it's funny. And then,
all of the detail in their uniforms and their postures, like just seeing like the feet of one guy. And it's great.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. When I saw that, I was like, that's my panel. And I didn't overthink it this week.
Yeah, you did what I usually do. this time I did something different. We talked about this a tiny bit, but my panel was Strange Tales number 121, page 23, or it's like page 7 or 8 of the Doctor Strange story. It's panel 2. Mordo is trapped in the two cool visualizations of magic by Ditko in the story. So we talked about this a little bit, but the first, so this one is the one that looks sort of like his sigil or the window in Bleecker Street, but it's wrapping around him in such a cool and bizarre way. I've never seen anything like it, you know? And that's what Ditko does. And that's why it's so great that he's doing this comic is it's just weird, but it makes sense in that world.
Yeah.
He's hitting his stride there.
It's a really simple thing, but it looks like it's breaking space.
Yeah. Like, it's so graphic and illustrated. Yeah. Like graphic design. It's just solidly made. And it looks like it's a thing. Yeah. Like it has always existed and you just didn't know about it till Ditko showed you.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is one of his powers. And the other, so this, that is my panel.
Yeah.
There's a few panels of Mordo trapped in this and on that page, but just before it is when Mordo is attacking the astral or ectoplasmic form of Doctor Strange with, and you mentioned this, in another super graphic, weird, cool use of space. It looks like it was just meant for like a poster.
Is that the one where he's like pushing him into the corner?
Yeah,
the
with
panel?
Like red, orange, and yellow, sort of this fire thing that's going down in an arrow
exactly
shape. And there's
about.
There's two pieces of that, and it shows him forming this cloud, and then it shows him making that, pushing with that. And both of those are just so, there's nothing like it in any comic book.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure in some of the, I don't even know, in some of the, the pre-existing sci-fi and horror anthologies, like it's just so weird and specific to this universe. So I was so surprised to be like, Doctor Strange nailed it this time.
Yep. And totally did.
And blew my mind. Yep. Like I couldn't stop thinking about it from the minute I saw, especially that Mordo in the white with sort of this yellow background and these weird sort of tendrily black shapes going around him. It's just awesome.
Yeah, I loved it. That was such a good looking comic. And Ditko, like Joe Keating said it a couple episodes ago on the podcast, but like he believes that at this point, Ditko was the most fully realized artist in the Marvel bullpen. And I think that's absolutely correct. Like he had his thing dialed in and he was doing it perfectly. And he was able to, he had a lot of control over his stuff because he inked his own pencils and he just knew exactly what he wanted to do and how he wanted to do it. And he executed flawlessly.
Yeah. It's hard to even explain. And when you see it, it still feels like a 60s comic, you know, if you're thinking from this sort of modern aesthetic, but it's totally different.
Yeah.
And Spider-Man too, but this is where Doctor Strange got super cool for me.
Yeah.
Just this issue, there's been interesting things, but this was like not two guys staring at each other. It was a lot of cool use. And also with the characters just being white with a black outline when they're in their astral forms and then all this color around them.
Yeah.
It's just awesome. He's just such a great designer. It's like beyond it for me from graphic design and doing design work. It's like, that's what it looks like. It looks like an illustrator and a designer worked on this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a, It was a good month for Doctor Strange.
Yeah, it and was.
It was a good month of comics generally. Yeah. Like I really enjoyed all of this. We hope you will all come back next week and check that one out. And between now and then, you can find us on Instagram at Marvel by the Month. Please drop us a line anytime at marvelbythemonth@gmail.com. If you want to drop a voice memo recording into an email, it might show up in the podcast at some point.
Can't wait for that to happen.
That's going
to
be real cool. And then also, you know, our website has all the information that you could want and more, including all of our other social handles. That's marvelbythemonth.com. That's all we got for right now. So yeah until next time, I'm Brian Stratton.
And I am Rob Milne.
And we will see you next week for next month.